Well, I want to thank you. Thank you, organizers, and thank you all for showing up here, because I think this is one of the grand challenges of our generation and the next, is how are we going to sustainably improve production and also performance, livelihoods, in a rapidly world of change. I think another challenge is going to be just seeing me over this podium here. But, but I'll do my best. I'm usually not invisible despite being a little bit height challenge. So I also want to thank my partners, certainly the donors and the institutions that we've worked with, which I'll be sharing experiences from, and most of all the people in my research group, and then the amazing people, including the farmers in some parts of Africa in particular. So imagine you are a farmer in Zimbabwe trying to feed your family on this acre of land, dealing with the uncertainties that, even though this looks very different, that your neighbors, your farmers here in Minnesota face as well, weather uncertainties, but also everywhere in the world, we can't forget the market uncertainties. Where are you going to get your inputs? Where are you going to be able to sell your crop? So these uncertainties are there. And getting worse, we have more extreme events. As we heard, we have more information tools, but we also have more uncertainties, not just in terms of dry spells and heat, but also flooding. In Michigan, where I'm from, Michigan State University, we have had some, 8 inches in some places in recent years, and have falling in one day. So this is happening all around the world. This is from Malawi, this picture. And I want to talk about these uncertainties because, as Sandra Beatty has published, there is tame problems in this world and wicked problems. And the uncertainty is a big aspect of what we call wicked problems. Value conflict is also part of this. So by that we mean sustainable intensification. We consider environmental goods and services and production. These sometimes are in conflict, so there's a value conflict there. When we talk about tame problems, even if they're very complex, like getting a man on the moon, people were able to solve that with engineering, with reductionist science. You control everything else, and you learn to have hypotheses, and you can test it. What's called normal science by Sandra Beatty. But what about wicked problems when we have high uncertainty and high value conflict? And I think we'd all agree that sustainable intensification is the wicked problem. Then action research comes in, adaptive science, and I will be giving some examples of that. In fact, I'm going to talk about investments in people and action research, context, understanding context, which many of us as agronomists are about, and action research, and then options, developing sustainable intensification options in particular, which many agronomists, including many in the room, are working on. First, I'm going to start with rice systems. We're going to go to South Asia, and in fact, particularly appropriate, I think, for this meeting where we are in collaboration with our entomologists. One of my personal heroes happens to be Dr. Kale Hyung, an entomologist. So over decades, he conducted action research in Vietnam, which I want to talk about here, investment in people to improve their capacity in this campaign he called the Three Reductions, Three Gains. So first he looked at his problem, he did diagnosis, and he found that farmers were spraying early and often, maybe partly because of this giant grasshopper here that they came in their fields, or of course much smaller in real life, but still fairly dramatic when they show up, and not surprisingly, farmers sprayed. But these leaf feeders do not reduce yield from the entomologist's viewpoint. They knew that there's actually, when you spray early in your rice production season, you can actually exacerbate problems. Why? Our IPM colleague earlier wouldn't be surprised. In terms of, you kill some beneficials. You may have secondary pests come in that wouldn't have been a problem otherwise. So there was an information gap, okay, between what the entomologist knew and what farmers' practices were. But instead of coming up with an extension recommendation saying farmers should go out and stop spraying early in the season, he took an action research approach. So he worked on mass communication campaigns with the Ministry of Education in Thailand, the Ministries of Extension in the Philippines and in Vietnam, and he got millions of farmers trying for themselves, demarcating an area of their field and testing, did they need to spray early if they looked at the different types of pests there. He would challenge them to see if they needed to spray, because in one area they didn't spray, made some observations. Other areas they did their normal management approach. And a number of years later, it was a long-term action research project. It's been shown through rigorous surveys that 70% of smallholder rice producers that were part of these campaigns actually are reducing their pesticide use and are actually reducing toxicity to their local communities for themselves, and they're enhancing their profit. So a very clear example of sustainable intensification, I would say, through this action research approach with families. So I'm also going to talk a bit about context, understanding context, the soil biophysics, and in this case residue management shown in the photo, but also the socioeconomic context. So what does this mean? Well, if we think about West Africa, we go to the sorghum growing areas across all of West Africa there in that rainfall zone. ICRISET has the mandate for improving sorghum production. That's the center of the CG centers based in India. So not surprisingly, they have the mandate for semi-arid tropics. And sorghum, which is one of the, sometimes called the workhorse or the camel of agricultural production in these semi-arid zones. So what happened? Well, over decades, sorghum in West Africa, the improvement of it was seen as kind of a case where the Green Revolution really lagged, where I was hired by ICRISET in the mid-90s, and I remember going to West Africa, and it wasn't just farmers that weren't adopting these new improved varieties. The agronomists were not using them, so I knew there must be something wrong with the whole system. So these improved varieties apparently were not improved because they were not being adopted. So Dr. Ava Weltzien, also another hero of mine, and her husband, Fred Weltzien, Redtun, together were brought to by ICRISET to Mali in West Africa and taking on this somewhat intractable problem. And first they looked at the context, and they particularly looked at, turned out poor soil fertility was a massive issue. And in fact, the breeding for improved sorghum varieties had been done in much higher soil fertility than what was the farmer's environment. They also looked at what was the purpose of these crops. Well, the improved varieties were very good at increasing yield, but in an area with a lot of livestock, forage was just as important. So dual-purpose crops were what were needed. They used every tool. I think this is very important. They used participatory on-farm breeding, they used marker-assisted breeding, and in really exciting work with hybrids, where they're actually getting farmers to try to produce their own hybrids through co-ops. So first, the context. So this soil phosphorus map shows you phenomenally low for two-thirds of the area and less than 10 parts per million phosphorus available P. And interestingly, as a colleague presented earlier today, women's fields were almost always less than 4 parts per million, so the ones that women traditionally manage. So very low soil fertility. So you can imagine something bred for much higher fertility might not even thrive, might not establish well in that environment. So they did, I would call, action science through understanding this context, paying attention to what farmers actually had to deal with, because there's very low fertilizer use and even access to fertilizer in this part of the world. They developed a low phosphorus field, you can see here, where maybe the sorghum didn't look great, but it was a great selection environment for something that could thrive in that very harsh environment. They also have used thousands of on-farm trials, so in the actual environment that farmers are going to grow these sorghums. They retained dual-use varieties, varieties that are good for actually multiple use, construction from the sorghum stems, fodder, and obviously grain for food and for drink, and then also cash for selling. It's one of a classic example of really interdisciplinary work involving breeders, leading it, working closely with agronomists and socioeconomists. And I'll just show you one slide, although there's many other aspects of their success, and this is how their hybrids are now truly improved varieties. So even this is the environmental mean on the x-axis, and even at the lowest marginalist environment, they're still, these hybrids are able to outperform the current most popular local varieties. So they really made a difference in terms of being able to, by paying attention to their context, develop these new options. So let me talk a little bit about options and sustainable intensification options, and we're going to go to Southern Africa, some of my own work in Malawi in particular, where we've been focused on trying to develop options for farmers. Now, we looked at this system, which happens to be one of the most maize-dominated landscapes in the world, more than Iowa, Minnesota, Mexico. So this maize-dominated landscape really was short on soil fertility. Even with some of the recent access to fertilizers, there's still not the response you'd expect to see, perhaps partly because of soil degradation. So we've worked trying to bring improved legume options, in particular, to farmers. Well, the annuals were actually very popular, like common bean, but didn't do much for the soil. There's nothing much left over after you get a good yield off of a bean crop or a soybean crop. But when we tried a whole range of perennials, agroforestry technologies, these are often called, we couldn't get any traction. Farmers would try them, but the fuel wood and the soil fertility benefits were just something they couldn't quite invest in because they're really on the edge of survival. So we found that there was a sweet spot in between where pigeon pea, Cajenus cajun, and also climbing bean, something that grows for a year or 2 years, that provides a real shot of soil organic matter, nitrogen fixation, even phosphorus access, is able to also produce food. That's the important point. So this is something that is an option that is actually addressing multiple needs at once and has somewhat been neglected. Some of the improved varieties have actually gotten shorter and shorter and don't have some of the forage or soil fertility benefits that some of the land lines. So we need a wider range of these types of options in our view. We also wanted to see where they could be disseminated, and we found that although they're traditionally grown in southern parts of Malawi, this is a picture of Malawi here, in fact that some of the newer varieties are very well suited for the middle of the country. So we could try action research, and this is where we've been working with over 1,400 farmers supported by USAID and their Africa Rising Farming Systems Project, working with many national partners and IITA, International Institute for Tropical Ag. So we've been focusing on how do these perform, how can they be integrated into farmers' systems. So this requires action research where farmers themselves rank these technologies, where we use some of the outputs and we set up modeling to try and see in a changing climate or in different parts of the country under different soil fertility conditions. You know, maize with fertilizer, which is shown on the top there, especially in a high fertility soil, does very well, even as temperatures increase until they get up to 4 degrees over baseline. But if you have modest resources and only enough to one bag of fertilizer, so 92, instead of 92, you have 24 kgs of nitrogen, well, then in a rotation system, that, especially if you have it with pigeon pea there to really give you a shot of nitrogen and perhaps some soil health building, then you can actually start to see some really robust and buffered systems at really modest costs. So the modeling lists extend beyond our current options. And here's some system that we've developed in close collaboration, is action research with farmers and extension. This is a doubled up option. So this is two legumes. Traditionally, pigeon pea is grown with a cereal like maize or sorghum. But if you grow it with groundnuts, or what we call commonly U.S. Peanuts, or soybeans, some other type of a shorter duration grain legume that is complementary in terms of phenology over time, because it gets growing early, then the pigeon pea comes in as a bush, you can see here later. That's all from seed, 1 year. And then in the second year, sometimes it's ratooned, so cut back, and then you can grow with maize again. You can get a real shot of legume input, but you're also getting two grain crops. And in the second year, you're getting pigeon pea again, and then maize. And then in the third year, you may get a really, sort of like you've improved your whole system, and so then you get a real jump in any kind of maize response to inputs. So this doubled up option is something that's really gotten some traction and is coming out of this action research. So by coincidence, I have also the genetics by environment model or formula that we heard earlier. Sometimes it's G by E by M for management practice equals yield. This is has got us quite far on the Green Revolution. But what I'm proposing here is we think about, if you take one thing away from this talk, think about options by context equals performance. So we come up with sustainable intensification options. We have to understand the context, and then through action research, investments in people, they can get the type of performance that they want. So I would just challenge you to think about, in your own work, what sort of action research can you do with people, or understanding the context, or developing new options as we try and address sustainable intensification in our lifetime. Thank you.
Well, I've been very educated by all of the presenters and very inspired by what I've learned. And on behalf of the Union of Concerned Scientists, I'm very grateful to the Tri-Societies and to the Entomological Society, as well as to the Climate Corporation, for the opportunity to join these speakers and to add to the perspectives that we've been invited to provide. So before I get started, I want to make sure that you know that I'm honored to be a part of the panel of distinguished speakers like this, and I don't want you to blame either the organizers or any of them for anything scandalous that I might say here, and particularly poor Manjit, who's just moderating. All of these people were just asked to participate, so they're just here as a result of being kind and being generous for their knowledge. So those of you who read the synopsis for the session, no doubt noted that there was an intention there not to be overly provocative, it said. And I think I'm going to behave badly here because I'm going to break with that intention, because what I actually think was meant by that was that none of us mean to be offensive, and I agree completely with that. But I think all of us have given up too much time, particularly we've paid too much to come all the way here and not to be provoked. So if you'll allow me, I think the framers of this session envisioned a forum where we would consider a range of perspectives on the prospect for sustainably supporting humanity. And I'm intentionally referring to that goal as a prospect because it's clear we're not accomplishing that objective at present. As the director of the National Institute for Food and Agriculture, Dr. Ramaswamy, astutely pointed out during his opening plenary on Sunday evening, for those of you who were here, humanity faces an existential prospect right now. We're not talking about some diffuse point in the future. And this is significant because there's a difference between sustaining today's success, something that we know how to do well today, in any given enterprise, and a scenario where we don't understand how to achieve our stated goal today, much less in the future. And particularly when we refuse to accept that and talk boldly about what we'll do in the future. So this is not just a philosophical point, because there's actually a third alternative to consider on the question of sustainably supporting humanity. And that is that on the available evidence, we really don't propose to do any such thing, but that making the claim assuages us, even if it doesn't actually provide useful cover. But maybe it does provide useful cover for completely different purposes that have a payoff very much in the present, and even then, only for some of humanity. So consider that per the statistics that any of us can consult through the United Nations FAO stat data set, which you know itself is aggregated from reports that are issued by global governments, the globe already produces enough food to meet the objective of nourishing 9 billion people. So this is very contrary to the cant that we hear incessantly at the start of almost every talk of our dearly beloved societies. The globe's major agricultural areas are actually suffering from the problem of overproduction, with the very real consequences of depressed prices to farmers and a retrenchment in the investments of the input and insurance industries that depend on the farm economy. So the problem in these major industrial production belts, of which we are all in this room, an intrinsic part because we help generate the knowledge with which this system operates. We produce the people who populate the ranks of farmers, of researchers, the vendors. Their problem is figuring out what to do with that excessive production. And I emphasize that this is production so abundant that in places like the one where we are right now, here in the Midwest, the majority of acres can be devoted to non-food uses. And a significant amount, at least a third, of the food that is produced can be wasted, not counting the food waste that is represented by the part of the supply that simply goes into making wealthy people obese, diabetic, and premature cardiac cases, which is surely food waste as much as a half-eaten salad or a banana that goes into the waste bin. So this, quote, food system is not a philanthropy, which is the basic reason that our altruistic goal of, quote, feeding the world, unquote, is literally fatally disconnected from the reality that costs must be covered and therefore production of an adequate amount of food does not equal all of the people who could be fed are automatically fed. So the problems of this food system are completely different, really, actually, than nourishing the hungry. They're about creating markets, paying markets. It doesn't matter who pays, companies or governments. The objective is to create markets that pay. Or about inventing markets for a supply that we have completely figured out, not about meeting demand. It takes no effort to demonstrate this, and I quote you from this morning's farms.com. Literally, this was the first thing I saw when I opened up farms.com this morning. You can go check yourself. With an abundance of soybean supply coming out of South America and the United States this year, global demand is as important as ever. While it would be easy for the U.S. soy industry to rely on its number one customer, China, it knows it cannot put all of its beans in one basket. The Soy Checkoff and its partners are busy in other markets as well, looking for new customers and innovative ways of using a bin-busting crop. With such a huge supply of soybeans coming out of the United States each year, it is essential for demand to be strong in a variety of markets. We need a global demand to continue growing, says John Bays, who monitors global soybean markets for the Soy Checkoff, probably a good friend of many of you. We had record growth in global demand last year, and here's the key thing. And we need for that to continue to offset our growth in supply. So, therefore, what we agricultural scientists need to accept is that our objectives around raw productivity have been met. We know how to do that. And that the actual questions to confront regarding sustaining humanity are such things as, what shall we produce? For what purpose? For whom? You heard Sig phrase many of these in terms of the studies that she's doing. How about these questions? How should we produce in such a way that we don't preclude our capacity to sustain that success indefinitely? And how can those who are poor, the folks that ostensibly are motivating us, how can those who are poor either produce the food that they need for their families and their communities, or how can the poor and hungry earn what they need in order to afford food? To link up the difference between having sufficient production of nourishment and actually having hungry people taking advantage of that. So you'll note that these questions boil down to very pragmatic questions. These are actually the wicked questions that Sig told us about. They're about control over land, control of the supply chains for basic production factors such as water, nutrients, energy, and that this in turn means that political and economic power is at the root of confronting hunger. Really, who has access to land and factors of production, water, nutrients, and energy? We devote armies to answer these questions. I'm here to voice the agroecological perspective. You may be wondering how we get there. So, this is the perspective where these observations that I'm making here are not afterthoughts for people who seriously mean to engage with complex systems-based approaches to the toughest questions humanity is ever likely to encounter. One of the founders of this integrative discipline is Dr. Steve Gleisman, and he defines agroecology after having worked for 40 years with farmers, with communities, with scientists, doing very much the type of action research that Sig just described to us. He refined this concept, and it sounds like this. Agroecology is a whole systems approach to food, feed, and fiber production that balances environmental soundness, social equity, and economic viability among all sectors of the public, including international and intergenerational peoples. Inherent in this definition is the idea that sustainability must be extended not only globally, but indefinitely in time and to all living organisms. So what you'll note, that's the end of the definition, what you'll note in that is that integration across place, across time, and all biology are inherently integrated in this particular view. This is a perspective wherein it's not a surprise that higher organisms have, quote, microbiomes that are intrinsic to the success of the higher organisms, quote, higher organisms, because the higher organisms are contingent on the microbes and the microbiome. So in this perspective, we're not surprised by that. And consequently, even when human beings are managing agroecosystems for human purposes, we could actually say, especially when humans are managing agroecosystems for human purposes, multiple elements must be managed to optimize performance of the whole system, not just the specific component, such as productivity. The objective is not just productivity. And this doesn't mean that productivity is sacrificed. It means that productivity and other components share importance. So you will all remember that our first attempts to define agricultural sustainability, I'm talking about the dark era back in the 90s, all took this kind of a form. We're aiming for X while subject to constraints 1 through N. Every definition from that era had that particular pattern. So, you know, X was productivity. So that was the prime objective, but then we had constraints so that we don't pollute the environment, for instance. You know the litany. We were still in swaddling clothes and indoctrinated in the orthodoxy of productivism and learning to frame our thinking about sustainability. So today it is far more common to find definitions like the one that I just read to you that are of the form 1 through N, multiple purpose management is our objective, which actually I think is the common thread that we can find among all panelists here, finding ways in which we can integrate knowledge and apply that to integrated management. So this agroecology field is a burgeoning field of research, and it is dramatically underfunded. It is literally a cutting edge of knowledge, how to take information from systems such as the ones that SIG completely coincidentally, I swear to you, just illustrated for us, where we have complexity that we've designed into the system rather than a monoculture that we're attempting to optimize for one thing, its productivity. So the reason why I can say to you that this field is underfunded is that when we at the Union of Concerned Scientists began to advocate the public sector to invest more in this arena, the obvious question was, of course, how much is actually being spent right now and what is the demand? Are there researchers out there that would actually have the expertise and the interest and know what to do with more public funds if we devoted those resources to that purpose? And so we had a team of scientists, our agroecologist Marcia DeLange, and a couple of her colleagues from the University of California, Berkeley, Liz Carlisle, and from the University of Hawaii, Albie Miles, look into the question. They've just recently published their paper on this topic if you want to go refer to their methods and to more specific outcomes than what I'm going to summarize for you here. But what we know about how much we spend as a public sector to advance this cutting edge of agricultural science, multiple purpose management of biologically complex system, is that when you look at NIFA investments in grants, competitive grants made to researchers for this purpose, under the most generous interpretation, where there's at least some component of an agroecological approach, about 15% of those grant funds are awarded to people that are going to be doing something around agroecology. If you adopt a more strict interpretation, such as these folks mean to do agroecology, not just include components of agroecology, then the amount of funding drops by an order of magnitude to 1.5% of all research awards that NIFA has made. Now, this is for research that began in the calendar year 2014, where we hope to establish a baseline that we can then use for comparisons in the future. You should know that we work with Dr. Ramaswamy and his team at the National Institute for Food and Agriculture. Felita Lyles, who runs the CRIS database, that all of you provide information for, and others within NIFA at USDA in order to generate this information, and that Marcia actually worked with them on the most recent agroecosystems panel to help make decisions about how to award those funds, so that they're very receptive to the argument that this is an arena of science that is underfunded and we all need to learn what would be an appropriate amount to invest in this arena. Now, apropos of Dr. Ramaswamy, those of you who were actually here Sunday evening will remember that he stated, and then he reaffirmed when somebody in the audience asked the question just to make sure, that obesity, sustainability, and the food system are interrelated, and you cannot deal with the challenges of any one of them independently without dealing with all of them simultaneously. So, Dr. Ramaswamy actually articulated the agroecological perspective. That is exactly the view. Now, I want to quote to you from a blog that Marcia's colleague Liz Carlisle and one of our colleagues here at the Institute for Ag and Trade Policy in Minneapolis just recently published, where they summarized our findings and what their importance might be, because there's this particularly acute statement that they make. If our food system, remember Dr. Ramaswamy's statement, if our food system causes nitrate pollution, climate change, obesity, diabetes, and biodiversity loss, while undermining the very soil quality it depends upon for its own long-term viability, isn't it time to find a better way? And that is what agroecology proposes to do. And isn't it time to invest in that purpose? The system that we have at the moment is the result of public investment, a concerted public investment. So we can generate a different system with completely different objectives. Now, what I'd like to do is actually be responsible to the organizers of the session. And Manjit, how much time do I have? Am I done? Okay, I am done. Well, then never mind. I'll be irresponsible to the organizers of the session, because what they did was to provide us five questions that they wanted us to address specifically. So maybe during the panel discussion, we can actually bring those up. Thank you.